on joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's technical question and answer net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide a cogent answer, and Jason, WF2N, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Jason, WF2N. Good evening, Jason.
Good evening, Ryan. Good evening to everyone listening on the net.
Okay, so let us begin another technical net. I hope there are questions out there. If you have any questions or any topics you would like to discuss or comments you would like to make of a technical nature, or you're returning with a question that you had and you experimented and found something out new, all those things are possible for the technical net. So if you have any of those, please give me your first name and your call sign.
To NVB with a couple probably quick questions about propagation.
Bob, we'll have you on the list. I hope we haven't caught you during dinner time, as always.
Just finished. I even washed most of my dishes. Back to net.
Very good. So I'm not going to feel too bad if I pull you to ask your questions early. Anyone out there would like to be added to the list, please give me your first name and your call sign. I am assuming, as per usual, as time goes on, more people will be checking in with questions. So, Bob, what's your question for tonight?
Boy, hi, everybody on the net. This is Bob, Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor, Bravo. Yeah, these are questions I think I know the answers to, but just to confirm, it's about my difficulties getting through to you on the 10-meter net, which is, well, the obvious reason is of my situation of just having a magnetic loop inside a Faraday cage apartment, just like your own that you describe with chicken wire in the walls. But anyway, it's just one. I think it makes no difference, but like, for example, last Sunday, when propagation was very good for people from, in the Midwest, Southeast, yet it's still bad for me. And I think, obviously, that's, to me, to confirm, that's about bouncing off E-layers and stuff, whereas, of course, when I transfer to go to you, it's just ground waves. So it probably has actually no connection at all. So just to confirm or deny that. the other thing is I used to have this horrible hum right on 28.380 that interfered with me listening to the net, which was horribly annoying. It went away. Whatever the thing was, somebody moved and took something with them or whatever, and I can hear you guys a whole lot better than I could before. Just the usual noise, not this horrible hum. But I don't think that makes a bit of difference in transmitting, and I'm pretty sure of that too, but just to confirm or deny that. So those are two simple questions. Back to net.
Bob, the noise in your background that annoyed you and made it difficult for you to copy us didn't really affect us because it was a local phenomenon, most likely. And hopefully, whatever piece of equipment caused that noise got either the person moved or the equipment broke and they threw it away. Or it could be that as it aged, the component simply wandered off to cause RF noise in a different portion of the RF spectrum. So that's always a possibility. As far as propagation, you were pretty much correct. Most of our propagation during especially the sunspot, the doldrums, when we're not actually getting to talk to Florida or in Indiana and Illinois and such, is through ground propagation. That's where buildings and hills and dales and all kinds of things gets in the way. I mean, it's not all through ground propagation necessarily. There are these things called near vertical incident sky waves. These are antennas that are designed to radiate straight up and bounce right back down. They're very good for local communications. If you take a dipole and you put it really close to the ground, it makes a decent near vertical incident sky wave. So there are antennas that are not really designed with good takeoff angles for distant propagation, but they kind of spread the RF locally. But as I said, most of what's going on with us here in Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island and New Jersey is pretty much ground propagation. I don't think anyone has a near vertical incident sky wave running.
Copy of that. So if that hum, it just wandered, because it's not nearby either. I kind of spun the dial, but maybe what you're saying is it could even just go to a very different frequency by wearing out a little bit. Is that what you mean? That's a possibility as well?
I mean, these things kind of move all over the place. I don't know exactly what it is. I always kind of blame locally. The subway yards are only about three blocks away from me, and every so often there's this strange VHF waveform. It's very, very wide, and it kind of it does a dance routine. It goes a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right, and then eventually sometimes it just slides completely off of the amateur radio 2 meter band where I don't bother to look for it anymore. So it can change locally nearby, but it can, you know, all these are poorly designed harmonic circuits. So as these components age, a lot of times their frequency can shift significantly.
Copy that. Well, I'm just happy it left. Wherever it went or whether it just disappeared, it makes listening to the net a whole lot easier, and I can copy you a lot better. Another strange thing is that I think we talked about this a little before, of Howie, MSU, he typically often copies my signal better than you do because of his elevation, I guess, but I copy your signal a lot better than his. Well, I guess that's because you have an 800-watt amplifier running. That's probably a lot of that. So back to that.
Unfortunately, you know, as Dick K2RIW always told us about the reciprocal effect, and there is to a degree, you know, what an antenna radiates out is very consistent with the signals that it absorbs. When you start to factor in linear amplifiers, reciprocity kind of falls apart. So it's probably, as you mentioned, the fact that I'm throwing out about 800 watts, and I think Howard is going barefoot. I don't know if he's going something like 80, 90, or entire 100 watts. So his location is elevated, so that gives him a benefit. He has better ears, and my linear gives me a louder mouth.
Yeah, because when he transmits, typically I can hear, like you say, the characteristic of his voice. I know it's him, but I cannot make out any of the words, or at least not enough to get any kind of coherent understanding. Whereas you, I can almost always hear you, especially now without that hum. So, yeah, I guess that's all I have for now. I got a couple of virus questions, but I can hang on to that for later. So, unless you want me to do it now. Back to net.
I'll throw out a request for anyone with any questions. If they do, we'll go to them first. Otherwise, I'll go back to you. So, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. If you have any questions of a technical nature or topics you would like to have discussed or comments that you would like to make of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
K3CHB Mobile, coming up 78 westbound, back to Pennsylvania.
What's your first name, sir?
The make of the machine, okay. The name is Jimmy, Julia India Mike. I'm originally a resident of Bergen County, New Jersey, but I'm living in Pennsylvania now and just heading back home. I don't have much technical questions. Right now I'm running an FT818, my wife's mobile, with a half-wave dual band antenna, half-wave 2-meter dual band antenna on a magnet mount. I'm making it okay. And where is this machine located? Over.
This machine is located in downtown Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, excellent. So I guess I'm making it okay with my measly six watts. But I was listening to you, it was very interesting what you're saying, and this is a very interesting net. I like the way you run it. I just wanted to say hello, and then I'm just passing through the area.
Okay, very good, Jim. Glad that you were able to check in. Well, like I said, we do this on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. on this repeater. If you like technical nets, I also host another technical net on the Limark repeater, W2VL. It's approachable by IRLP and Echolink, and we stream it sort of the same way on the Internet. That's on every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
Is this machine linked up now?
This machine is not really linked up on the analog side. It is a Fusion Digital Technology repeater, a DR2X. And so when you switch over to the Fusion Digital mode, we have a WiresX room that is accessible through hotspots and WiresX through another Fusion radio.
Yep, I'm familiar with Fusion. I have that in my, I have a 2-meter 440 Fusion rig in my other vehicle. But just analog here on the 818, but I just want to say thanks for having me check in at 73. Again, this is Jimmy, Kilo 3, Charlie, Hotel Bravo, K3CHB, headed westbound.
Very good, Jimmy. Thanks for checking in. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club's technical net that meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. If anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature or topics they would like to discuss or comments they would like to make about some technology, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2NVP with one more 10-meter net technical question.
Okay, Bob.
Quick one. This is actually more of an interesting question than me saying that I could hear you better than I could hear Howard, even though he could hear me better. Why does he hear me better than I hear him? Because I have the weaker signal of 60 watts from the inferior antenna, and I'm going to guess an answer that by the time his signal gets to me, of course, it's, you know, inverse square law, a whole lot weaker than his probably 100 watts beginning. It's some kind of milliwatts or whatever. And that might be harder to get through my Faraday cage than my 60-watt signal to get out of the Faraday cage. That's just one guess I had. So, anyway, that was the question.
It's a good question. There's a benefit to height with the high end of HF. There's a benefit to power, and it's impossible to come up with a nice clean equation that what kind of gain is he getting that's offset by my 8-fold increase in power output. It's just one of those things. The sensitivity of your receiver versus his receiver is probably different. It's just the amount of signal that gets to you is needs a little bit of an extra boost, even with his elevated signal, elevated location of signal.
Still receives my signal that's inferior to his in every way, third forward versus 17th or what have you, from a weaker antenna from inside a Faraday cage. I don't know. Yeah, I guess there's just lots of variables.
Different receivers have different sensitivity. Matter of fact, that's one of the questions of tonight's puzzler about sensitivity. So his front end is probably a little bit more sensitive than yours. That's why there's that offset that he can hear you when you throw less power than he does.
My ICOM 7100 might have not as good a sensitivity as whatever he's using, which is, I'm guessing, probably a similarly priced radio, or maybe less because it's only 2 meters 440, but you know what I'm saying. He's probably not using some super high-end radio. But anyway, is that what you're suggesting?
It's one of those possibilities. I mean, as you mentioned, it's very complicated of what happens to signals. They're not perfectly reciprocal, unfortunately. There is some aspect of one-wayness that can be can occur for our propagations even locally. That's probably part of the mix. All front ends weren't created equal. I don't remember what his model radio that he usually uses is, Also, it's how you set your automatic gain. There's a whole bunch of different things that you can do to kind of pull stuff out of the noise.
Like, what kind of things for that? You got the same model radio, I know, so guys, throw me a couple clues.
Theoretically, you can narrow the filter, which isn't that flexible with R7100. I think it has three filter settings, and that's it. Some other radios have much more selectivity. They can narrow it down somewhat better than ours can. And also, sometimes the automatic gain controls can be manipulated better. They have the slow, medium, and high. Sometimes they can even put them, between those settings and such, and they can tweak the gain just enough that the noise is not too high, but the sensitivity is about as high as it could get.
GOT.
Forward and to GOT.
Didn't get everything. I stepped away from the radio for a little bit, but I know there was some discussion about our 10-meter net and about signals reaching each other on the net. Just wanted to say, obviously, we know that if Bob, if you could go ahead and try to put antenna outside, even temporarily, it would make a huge difference, at least in an S unit or two, from what you're running. And I wanted to make a note that when you do rotate that antenna even slightly, it makes a pretty big difference to me. The difference between me being able to hear you here at my base or not.
Yeah, I do rotate it sometimes, and I'm on the assumption that when I hear the other party better, they're also going to hear me that's the best position for transmitting as well. Maybe that's not always true. But, yeah, so I don't always do it because I have to run into the other room to do it, but I do that.
Not in the best location. Even trying to stick something like I've done in the past, whether I've been away on vacation in a motel somewhere, sticking a wire outside, even having the loop, because I've played around with an Alex loop, and there definitely is signal reciprocal types of receive and transmit. And I've run maybe maximum on CW, maybe 8 or 10 watts. And it's a real bear. It's a real challenge having one of those loops. But I've made a number of contacts with it, albeit it's a big challenge. And about the noise, I was going to ask Roy earlier about the noise he sees. I have a pretty bad noise here, especially from the elevator on HF. How your noise level is either on 40 or 80 meters, so I was curious about that.
I don't exactly know how to judge noises. It's what I've gotten used to. I don't have a lot as far as I can perceive. There's always that baseline there, no matter what. But other than when it's stormy weather and you get a lot of lightning hits going on in 80 and degree 40, 20, I don't really have any problem. I have these little spurs that occur on 10 at something like, I think it was 33 hertz intervals. They're very small. Sometimes they line up with, frequencies that I really want to use, but it was a little bit of a problem many years ago. The amplitudes were a little bit higher. They've kind of quieted down mostly, so they don't really cause much of a problem.
I understand. At my location here in the last 20 or 30 years, the noise on HF here has gotten progressively worse. At one time, I think when there were more of these neon signs, I may have had issues, but I would say below 14 megahertz, below 20 meters, it's a bit of a challenge, quite a bit of a challenge. And I know when Mel was around, you remember, we experimented with trying to null out the noise, which is definitely a good idea in an urban environment, using the sampling antennas, you know, that your rig can do. People have, tried that out to some degree of success. But about, Bob, your situation where you're at, and I know you probably thought mold this over, but if you could even try to put something very modest outside temporarily during the net or whenever you're on the air, it would help immensely.
Maybe just hanging a wire out the window, I don't know. My loop, it's a chameleon F-loop 2.0, and it's heavier than an Alex loop. It probably weighs about 7 pounds. And I'd be a little leery kind of trying to dangle it out, put it out the window with the risk that it would fall or something. But, maybe some other kind of antenna, something. Because that thought crossed my mind, to sort of stick the loop out the window, if I could figure out a safe way to do that. I should think about it some more.
That's at least an S unit or two, and that's huge. Because why would I know that? Because I've experienced that myself. With experimenting, I remember when I first got the Alex loop and I was messing around with playing around with the flex and using the tuning knob on it and just sticking the thing outside and what kind of a difference there is. Even my own structure here is quite a bit of a Faraday cage to a big degree. And I think from where you are, the structure of where you're at and even the geographic location is quite a bit of a challenge. So that's my two cents in TGOT.
Yeah, thanks, Howard.
And how well do you hear me when I'm running 100 watts?
Me and BB? You sound totally full quiet. You sound great right now. Oh, 100 watts. Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about 10 meters, of course. From home, it's not always that great. I'm not always sure where you are when you're transmitting. Back to you, Howard, but maybe not so great. The best, of course, is when you're in my neighborhood with your portable. That goes without saying.
also when I'm down by the 58th Street Pier, which I prefer to transmit from. But lately I've been operating the last few weeks. I got on late last Sunday, been fiddling with the FT8 mode. Been very pleasantly surprised at how effective it is, even using Whisper, with even trying to listen myself for the tones. And the sound card, you know, the software is able to pull it in, so that's been pretty impressive. So I don't know if you ever want to even mess around with using digital with low power. And I know I've gotten very good results running very low power on 80 and even 10 meters. This dipole that I have here plays pretty well on 80 on that portion of the band. All right, over to net control.
Very good. Thanks, thanks, Howard. As always, thanks, Bob. Howard, I was curious, have you ever played around? You mentioned FT8. FT8's kissing cousin is called JS8 Call. Have you ever tried that one out?
You know what? Let me look at the software here. I don't see it on this particular WSJT software. Maybe it is on there, but I haven't played around with it yet.
I think it's on a different piece of software. It's very closely related. The guy took the source code for FT8 and massaged it a little bit. It's I wouldn't call it rag chewers because it doesn't really give you that much opportunity to talk, but it's a little bit more than just spitting out canned RST codes and locations and call signs and such. There's text fields that you can actually send words or phrases back and forth. If you just do a Google search for JS8 call, you can probably find places that are downloading it. I don't think Joe Taylor himself with the WSGT-X software handles JS8 right now.
Nope, I'll look it up. But it sounds like fun. I think the very same people I spoke to about FT8 don't like it because it's not like, it's very impersonal, kind of like JT65. Just quick exchange, even automated to some degree, and then goodbye. I know the very people years ago when I started out with the digital modes like PSK, and actually before PSK, Amtor, Pactor, Ritty Bordeaux, ASCII, they like rag chewing. And it, you know, the number of the more dominant modes I think that people have been fiddling with recently are just like hello and goodbye. So some people don't like that, but interesting listening on 10 today, incidentally, talking about 10 on FT8. I've been hearing DX stations that I have not heard on CW or phone in a long time in the Indian, well, yeah, I guess you could say Indian Ocean, Europe, and elsewhere, Africa. And I was surprised that I hadn't heard these stations in quite some time on 10, but on digital, I've seen their text.
I mean, the beauty of Joe Taylor's software is that you can catch a signal that's below the noise floor. The price you pay is the symbol rate is slow as molasses. So if you were to have a conversation, a couple of sentences worth of a conversation would probably take about 3, 4, 5 minutes to transmit completely. FT8 is great for playing tag. If you want to complete your work doll, whatever, and put up a lot of wallpaper, it's a very good thing to play with. Milan is still probably doing it in Bulgaria. He was doing it in Queens, and he was able to do two or three different things simultaneously. He would just lean over and press a magic button, and it would trigger a response to the other guy. They would transfer their call sign and signal strength, and he would put it in his log. So if you want to play tag, it's a very effective means of doing that. If you want to have a conversation, not so much. That's kind of why the guy who wrote JS8 Call, he basically broke open FT8 to put a couple of text fields in it. It's still not great for conversation unless you really have a lot of patience. Again, because the symbol rate is just so slow.
slow, and I thought mTOR when I used to fiddle with that. And that was really harsh on some of the older rigs, because you'd be, I don't know if you don't, it sounds like basically crickets if you've ever heard an mTOR signal, and the thing, your transmitter would be keying, unkeying every, you know, every few, what is it, 20-some-odd milliseconds, whatever it is. So this is different, I guess, and it's able to hear, pull signals out of the ether, and that sounds pretty interesting. Maybe I'll read up on it. See, the thing is, on 10, even the higher bands, I found that, especially on the vertical, depending on how much rain or static that's out there, the signal, and I think kind of similar to your location, noise level sometimes does go up. But the last few times I was on signal, the noise level wasn't so bad on 10. So if there's some noise out there, it could be a bit of a challenge trying to pull very, very weak signals out of the ether. But I've been very impressed with FT8 since playing around with it since field day. I made a number of contacts during field day a few weeks back. So it kind of reminds me, you know, talking about long transmissions, this whisper thing. I experimented with a little bit with whisper on that software.
2GS. Well, they're very close to each other. They're both written, as far as I'm aware, by Joe Taylor, using sort of the same basic premise. He uses frequency shift keying to resolve signals into digital format, and then very similar to the way computers work, he has cyclic redundancy and error correction, subroutines, and again the very slow symbol rate, and all of those things together do magic for most of those. Every so often I look at these ads. SodaBeam makes a whisper transmitter in case you don't want to hook up your radios and set the controls and such. You just plug this little box in and it will send your identifier out, and you can open up a web page and see how far you're propagating.
Impressive that you could do that. So one of the things that I've done on bands where my antennas work pretty efficiently, the vertical I got ain't so bad on 10. I found that my sweet spot is about 10 to 20 watts on there, but for local activity, and it kind of reminds me what you're talking about with PacTor, or the other one, AmTor. But the throughput wasn't so bad. But I'm wondering, when you compare the modes, I guess the newer modes might be more efficient, being that you have better processors now. It's able to maybe pull some of this these signals through the ether better than maybe 20, 30 years ago. I don't know. But the thing I was going to say about some of these... 80 meters. One of the things I used to experiment with is I kept lowering the power, and especially on 80, I could run under 5 watts in workstations, especially close in as Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ontario, within a few hundred miles, and people could hear me running flea power, which is pretty impressive. So one of the things I like to do is just try to back the power down and see... see if the station's able to acknowledge me.
That's very good. Yeah, I mean, you know, propagation's very important. You know, power is nice if you have the ability, but a lot of times you don't quite need the amount of power that people throw back and forth to each other. So, you know, it's reasonable that there are times where, you know, QRP is a real thing, and people get their worked all states certificates. Some of them, it's not even a challenge for 5 watts. They bring it down to 300 milliwatts.
I'm going to laugh here. You probably know the term, but it's actually, when you run a watt or less, and there are stations that only run, but these guys have, you got to understand, they have very good antenna systems, will not run over 1 watt. It's called QRPP. Some people don't know that, and I don't have a good enough antenna system to do that, although you could maybe just experiment and try that. but I'm all for operating with the type of power you need. I still advocate more power for phone, especially when you're running on a wider mode. You don't want to strain people's ears. You need it. But CW and other digital modes, CW is kind of a digital mode anyway, zeros and ones, but you do need, you could run less power, but, you know, running QRP into like a bed spring on phone, sideband, is not something I'd recommend, especially not now with the sunspot, lack of sunspots.
I'm aware of QRPP. I don't know. If I wore T-shirts, one of them would probably say life is too short for QRP. But you know, different strokes for different folks. There's a bone of contention among QRPers as well, whether affected antenna gain should be factored into their ability. So that some QRPers have disdain for guys with very high gain tower antennas that they plug their 1 watt transmitters into. They think that that's kind of cheating as well.
I think those people are all wet. It ain't cheating. I'll take a quarter of a watt, half a watt, 1 watt. Let's say I'm on 15 or 20 meters, whatever. 6/6/6. You know, in the middle of Dubuque, Iowa is good enough for me with under 1 watt. You're running under 1 watt with the way conditions are into a wet noodle, and good luck with that.
But, yeah, it's the nature of amateur radio operators. There are guys out there who sit around apparently with clipboards trying to figure out if whatever you're doing qualifies to them as amateur radio. So I'm just pointing out that there's always a bone of contention someplace with some guy.
I guess that's their way of thinking, but I don't agree with it. I think go for the max whenever you can, if you need it. But don't run, legal limit and then some all the time just to say, okay, I'm holding this frequency just for the sake of holding it, and when you could run less power. Especially, I think, on digital. If you've got a good antenna system that hears and gets out well, I always say, especially with digital, for my own sake, I just say, keep it to the power level you need. I'm not all about QRO, even if I had, even if I can run 1,500 watts all day, no problem.
I mean, that's pretty much best practice that everyone should be trained to do. You use the power that's necessary to have the conversation, and you don't need to pound them with pin their needles and such. So, yeah, that's again just good practice. But there are people out there who really love to just kind of put the pedal to the metal. In the beginnings of Joe Taylor's software, they tried to get people to use very low power. But I've heard guys actually using FT8 with linear amplifiers. I don't know if that really gets you that much farther. I don't see the point, but I've read about it. So it only goes to show that if you give someone a toy, they'll try and break it.
All right, a comment in there?
This is WF2N. I just wanted to say, I've tried experimenting with this a bit and looking at PSK Reporter. And from my experiments out of my wet noodle antenna, I really need to use a linear to, at minimum, get to Europe. Otherwise, it's just pretty much local contacts, which is fine for WAS. But, if I want DX, I need to put in at least about, I find a little over 200 watts does it for me. That's okay. I'm okay with that on a linear, but I'm definitely not pushing legal limit. It's not necessary. That's all I wanted to say. Back to Nat.
Good, Jason. Well, I'm sure there's some guy out there who has a not quite legal linear, and he likes to crank it all the way up. So there's always one guy out there like that. You know, like guys who are using about 3 kilowatts of power for their car's stereo system.
This is what I do, and I've done it already. let's say you're running a low power radio, even if you've got a 100 watt transceiver, let me make sure I have it. So I'll run 8 to 10 watts from the exciter into the amp and run, that'll get you over 100 some odd watts, which I think, in my opinion, is, you don't want to, I don't like bringing a 100 watt rig all the way up to the top level. So this way you're running enough headroom on the amp as well as the rig. So running 200 watts is the sweet spot to get to Europe. Completely agree with that.
Agree as well. Whatever it takes, as long as, you know, there's a thought process going on. It's not power for power's sake, and some people just like to turn that knob up to 11.
Done it on 20, because I know the antenna's kind of mediocre on 20, and I'm thinking the other band, maybe 40, running low power on the rig, and sometimes if you got around 100, 150 watts to make the contact, because, the guy in Europe, let's say in G4 land or DL land or wherever, is probably running a really good antenna, and I know in the UK, what are they running for? I don't know that they're running that much power on the FT8 or whatever other digital mode, but so sometimes it's not going to be reciprocal with how well you're hearing each other.
Sort of surprised that that's not one of the data points that they transmit, but as far as I can recall, there's nothing for power rating in the pre-designed text fields. I might be wrong.
Too sure about that one.
I haven't looked at it in a while, and they could have changed it. They might have a brag, a button. You know, some of these data modes have what they call a brag button, which you personalize with some little information about yourself or your system, you know, what kind of equipment you're running. So they might include power and such in those types of things.
NCGOT, you brought back memories back when I was a kid playing around on Amptor and then Paptor back years ago with my Commodore 64, and I'm still looking at my PK-232, which is rather dormant now, and my buddy LW, I'm trying to remember his call, W2, he had a W2 call, original W2 call at the time. Anyway, he had a very verbose brag file, and he said, I was over at his house many years ago, showing me how to get everything working properly, and, some of these people on digital were real, real rag chewers on the keyboard. I mean, these guys having at least a 1 or 2 hour QSO was about the average.
That goes back to the good old days of RIDI. RIDI is kind of designed to just, depending upon if you were a touch typist or a hunt and pecker, you could go on for hours and hours. The it's not as insensitive to background noise as the modern digital modes. So, you know, your signal could just get washed out. The error correction was not terribly good. So it's very easy, and I've played around with RIDI, and signals fade in, fade out. You lose bits and pieces of the conversation as they're typing, but you know, it's pleasant. Pactor was a kind of packet design for radio to kind of mimic computers, and so they were associated with computers. It would plug them into the Pactor Amptor modems. A lot of the circuitry and algorithms, unfortunately, were patented. So that kind of limited, it made it expensive, and it limited the number of companies that could sell products. So partially, things like that probably killed it somewhat, although they're still around. You can still buy them, and I'm sure people still use them somewhere.
Considered a couple of years ago buying a new up-to-date time wave or whatever, and there were several hundred dollars, and I'm thinking, wait a second, am I going to be talking to myself on this damn thing? if I try to get on the air and look for these stations, what percentage when you have a breakdown, which guys are on what mode now? I mean, what's the mode du jour, I guess, when you think about it? Because I remember back then, in the 90s at one time, it was PacTor Packet, AmTor, the Ford Error Correction Mode, FEC. Rudy Bordeaux, as I think you had alluded to, very prone to QR and QRM. You'd lose the characters, but I know it was a big contest, huge contest. I don't know how much they're still using Rudy Bordeaux in contests and contexts. I don't tune around and listen enough for that, but I know a number of my rigs will decode, I think, Rudy Bordeaux and I think PSK and some other modes.
No, Rudy is alive and well. You don't hear it that much. There are contests. And when the contests come up, there's a lot of activity, and then it dies down to very spare. To my ears, the one digital mode that seems to be overwhelmingly the most popular right now is FT8. So many people want wallpaper that you go to any of the bands. You go to 20, you go to 40, and you go where they hang out. And because of the narrow bandwidth of the transmissions and the wide bandwidth of the detection software, you can watch as, 20 different people play tag with each other at the same time. So I'm thinking that that's definitely the most popular data mode.
Something like that. And one of the most impressive things I really enjoyed was PSK31 when I first tried it, looking at all the stations coming through on the waterfall, saying, wow, all this just through a sound card, because not that long before you needed a different interface device aside from just using the sound card. I mean, to me, just saying you could use your computer and your sound card to work with your rigs. And by the way, back in the days of when Sound Blaster, I think, first came out, I don't remember who I was talking to. They were at a computer show explaining, I don't know if I talked to you or somebody else about it, a long time ago, to one of the guys that worked for Sound Blaster. You know that name, obviously, being you've been a computer guy for a long time. Was very impressed. He was completely so shocked that hams were using that to communicate using the sound interface card.
That was good old Creative Labs. Everyone who had a early PC had a Sound Blaster on their daughter board because the only thing that the motherboard was capable of doing was beeping at those times. I mean, nowadays, unfortunately, Creative Labs, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but it probably does, and there's probably an external Sound Blaster. And probably an internal one that's gold-plated, because that's the nature of things. But it's a midget of what it once was. I remember those good days. You know, nowadays it's so easy to get pieces of equipment. I have these little devices, the Signal Link. They have a soundboard in them, and you can wire them up to external radios and feed the audio into your computer.
Miniaturized, all built into these even smart devices you have, whether you have an iOS device or an Android, where you could do all this decoding and all this magical stuff with a tablet or some type of other smart device, which is interesting. I'm not too sure about why people would need some of the, I guess if people are really into music and other things, they'll go with a more upscale sound, but sky's the limit when it comes to video cards. And I remember when I first got a Sound Blaster playing, what the hell game was that? One of the flight simulators for World War One, and then World War Two. You had these add-on packages. I'm sure you're remembering this. This isn't that many years ago, but some people out here, I think it's a lifetime ago.
It's the good old days. There's guys out there who are still sound snobs, and they will tell you that, well, it depends on who you talk to. They'll tell you that they want a more sophisticated daughter board in their computer so that they could have higher sampling rates and dithering to increase the bitstream numbers of the same exact data that's coming out anyway. Others will take a different route and say that they don't want anything running inside their computers because the RF is too noisy. So they'll buy a $400 USB dongle that does the digital analog conversion and be very happy and proud of themselves. So, you know, as long as they don't knock on my door and ask me for a handout so that they can afford these things, you know, if it makes them feel better, then so be it.
I said you could spend nothing or have integrated a video card because I've been just going to be getting a newer machine very soon, but it's a lower to mid-end machine. I don't think I'd ever really want to, unless I had money that I don't care throwing out. But I look at these video cards, and I guess as well as a sound card, and video cards, like, sky's the limit with what these people do. It's pretty crazy. I remember some kids, not that many years ago, that would used to get high-end PCs, and they spent many thousands of dollars every, probably two or three times a year, getting upgrading their video cards. And I'd be like, oh my goodness, this is crazy. But with regard to high-end audio, and I'm sure you know about this, I know people that get external DACs and like all sorts of high-end toys with their computer systems and dedicated audio stuff with external DACs. I'm sure you know a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. I just got a catalog from some high-end audio mail, you know, catalog mail-in company, and they're selling a whole line of turntables, selling a vacuum tube-based preamp devices and DACs and all kinds of incredibly expensive but shiny glow-in-the-dark things. So there's all manner of ways of spending your money. It's all fascinating. As far as the video, I remember when it wasn't enough to have an expensive video card. You had to slave them together. So you had these interlaced where one card would handle 1/30th of a second frame, and the other would do the other 30th of a second frame, and they would interlace them back to a full image. And you could throw out thousands of dollars for high-end video. And now I don't think they're really writing them that much for combined cards, so they're throwing a lot of processors in single cards, and it doesn't seem to be an end to it. Every year, the new generation of video cards come out because they're feeding a bigger and bigger video stream. They're going from quad density to kind of hyper quad density, and you know, they're trying to do refresh rates from, they started at 60, then it went to 120, and now it's nothing to have a refresh rate monitor that's 240.
You guys consider the resolution of the source.
And unfortunately, my signal seems to be getting noisy now.
Resolution of the source.
Okay. Once again, I don't know what quite is happening. Every so often, my little IC7100 acts a little weird. I don't know. The transmission's very, very noisy for some strange reason.
Sound card and the external device.
Got a sound card. I couldn't make it out entirely. I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you are taking MP3 resolution audio and you're playing it to a high definition DAC, it's not going to sound much different than the sound card in the computer.
With you, David, and I kind of mentioned that it's kind of pointless exercise, but they think that somehow if they dither and they massage the data, they can extract something. I don't know what they're trying to extract, but again, as long as they don't ask me to pay for it, you know, God bless America.
sky's the limit with audio systems integrated with now these, I'm trying to remember what they call it in the industry, but the sound media type of stream devices. I'm not talking about a NAS, but where you get audio and or video from these streaming devices. And this is for people that are into, that have theaters in their homes dedicated to audio and video.
I've seen that. They're NUCs. They're small, reasonably silent, but relatively powerful computers that can take video data and throw them up on a screen. And you put them in your home theaters, and you use them as the clients to a network-attached storage system sometimes.
High compression.
Say again, David. Unfortunately, I have to kind of listen with half an ear to another radio because for some odd reason, my ICOM's getting really noisy right now.
Acid, isn't streaming video super high compression?
But it depends. I mean, you can have it do whatever you want it to do. It depends upon how powerful your computer is. If your computer is very powerful and your transmission line feeding it is doesn't have the ability to put a lot of bits in, then you have to overly compress it. Theoretically, you don't want to add any more compression. At the very least, you want to stream it in real time and decompress it on your server.
So, if you have really good source and it's not overly compressed, you know, then you need the processing power to render the image on the television. So you get the best quality possible. But I think for streaming, you know, you're trying to fit it through a very small avenue, you know. And so the image quality can suffer. It depends, I think, on the source and on the processing power of a computer device and a television.
I would agree with you. It has a lot to do with... it's two-pronged, because we've had this conversation both here and on Limark. Some of the processing is usually left for the video to display. The display itself has a computer and takes a stream of some form in HDMI and puts it back together into a somewhat high resolution. The more expensive the processor, the better it's able to interpolate and give you a finer quality image. Sometimes it's dependent upon the render at the computer that's sending the HDMI signal. You can have a weak point in the chain. You need to have a strong processor to a degree for the computer that's acting as the server, and you need a decent processor at the other end of the video display. If both of them are good, then you're in. If one of them is bad, it's going to suffer. It's going to cause problems with the chain.
Do you know about the Mac Pro?
There have been many Mac Pros, so it depends upon which one. I don't know if you're alluding to the laptops or the desktops or the server. Some iterations of the most recent, the so-called cheese grater server can cost $20,000-$30,000.
It looks like a garbage can.
To your web browser, Mac Pro, Mexico Alpha Charlie, Papa Romeo Oscar, and see what you get.
I'm looking, and once again, the problem is the year. That's a brand that they bring out with, and they tweak and they change. It's basically their tower, and as Howard mentioned, In 2013, it looked like a little garbage can because they used a cylindrical form factor. But prior to that, it looked like a tower. And the latest, greatest one that I saw is the so-called cheese grater. They decided to have this kind of metal work on the front. I tend to think that they're overpriced for what they are. There's nothing inherently amazing about them. Up until now, they use Intel chips and they use the graphic accelerator chips. In the future, they're going to switch to their own Apple-manufactured RISC ARM architecture chips. But at this point, it's just a glorified PC that's running a Berkeley BSD flavor of Unix with a graphic user interface that's very nice.
Look at it again. You're talking about processing power for video. This machine, according to Apple, can process 8K video, theatrical projection, resolution. So you could basically blow people away with the most resolute 8K video. I don't know exactly how it works, but I do know that this processor would replace the one in the TV. I don't know if Apple is going to make any large screens to play back this material from these devices, but I do know that, you know, they'll play into 8K smaller screens, so you can render pixel by pixel. Very interesting.
I mean, they're always doing great things, and but you pay a heavy premium. But again, nothing that I am aware of is a game changer. They're using state-of-the-art consumer electronics. Again, their graphic cards are not their own. They're buying them third-party from the same people that buy PCs. And, you know, Intel chips are Intel chips. So none of the architecture is inherently different. None of the components are inherently different. So what they've done is they've built up a very expensive piece of equipment that can be mimicked probably for half the price with a slightly dodgier operating system with people who don't like to use Windows instead of OS X. But it to me, as far as I'm aware, it's no esoteric silicon. It's all commercially available silicon that they're using.
People at Apple said that this computer is designed so that you could use it for 10, 15 years, that every part of it is interchangeable and upgradable. So, you know, the limit it becomes much higher. But I will say that for the most part, PC or Mac, the hardware has come to its limitation that you can't go much further than where we are now. So maybe there's something that's going to be invented that will take the place of computers completely.
Anything is possible, and if we knew the future, we could invest in that company and make a lot of money. So who knows? But, you know, the engineering prowess seems to get better and better and better. We're packing more density memory. Memory is getting cheaper. Cores are getting, there's more and more cores. There's virtual cores. You know, computers haven't hit a wall quite yet, and there are people working on different designs for future computational devices. They're talking about, instead of using silicon, to use the stuff that blue LEDs are made out of, I forget the compound, but that's another type of semiconductor. There are other people who want to turn graphene into something useful for computers. There are other people who are working on optical circuits for computers so that instead of electrons being pushed back and forth, they're just exchanging photons.
Your life is, a person has to know what they want in order for them to get it. If they don't know what they want, they'll never get what they want, because nothing will be what they want. Then they'll complain and blame and cause misery to themselves and everybody around them. Say, you know, yeah, you can't let people tell you what you should want. You have to figure it out yourself, and there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
Okay, but ultimately, marketing is all about telling people what they should want. And marketing is not going to go away. And people don't quite know sometimes what they want. I always use the DVR as an example, the digital video recorder that was very successful in its time. It did a lot of time shifting. It revolutionized people's way of taking in entertainment. Prior to that, for the most part, even though you could do it with VCRs, it was too much of a hassle. People used to just not want to deal with it. But with DVRs, they could do time shifting. They could record their favorite shows and watch them at different times than they were aired. And if you at first told someone who never saw it before about it, they'd say, who cares? My VCR can sort of do that. But after the fact, it was difficult to pull these DVRs away from people. So marketing lives by trying to convince you that you want or need something that you don't know that you want or need. And sometimes technology improves beyond our ability to imagine it until it's here in front of us.
Yeah, maybe, but some people, you know, like me, when cable TV came out and I was watching 50 channels and there was nothing to watch, all evening I go through the channels, well, this is cable TV, it's got to be good. And, you know, I realized how much I really disliked television as it was at that time, which inspired me to create some other kind of television. But, you know, you got to know what you want, because if you don't know what you want, you live like a robot. You read from, you know, books and internet. You have no intuition at all. And nothing comes to you through an innovative mind or an inspiration, you know? And the marketers, they want to take that away from you and me. I say, no, you know, I read the message from the marketing company, I get the notification on my phone, my app, and my computer, and I say, no, I don't want to buy this, you know. Maybe there's something else. I wait for them to suggest something that I want.
You know, whatever works for you, David, as far as cable, it demonstrates an unfortunate reality that the talent is a limited supply. Just because you have a place to put things does not mean that you necessarily have enough people who are good at creating things to put them there. It took a long time to scale up to a degree, and even now there are a lot of awful shows, reality-based shows I find tediously boring. But again, different strokes for different folks, whatever amuses people.
But since that time, it might have been like 1978, 79, I decided that I wasn't going to have a TV at all, you know? So I'm not going to be inspired by marketers, and then whatever comes to me comes from some other place, you know, some bigger place, and then, you know, put it forth. You know, this is what I want to create. And I'm not so interested in what everybody seems to think that they like because somebody told them to like it.
And that's your right. There are a lot of people out there who have cut the cord. They've discontinued their cable subscription. There are other people who sold their television. I don't know. I think there's great stuff out there. There's mediocre stuff out there. And there's god-awful stuff out there. And you have to figure it out yourself and entertain yourself as best you can with the choices that you make. You know, YouTube is sort of the same thing. It's very informative, very, very nice, entertaining, informative producers, and then there are boring people doing boring stuff on it.
QSL. I try not to measure or judge things, you know. If it doesn't sit well with me, I just avoid it, that's all. Whether it's good or it's not good, whatever, has nothing to do with what my interest is, you know. I know that a lot of times I'll say things and it'll go like really, really far. People will run with the idea of create artworks, and big artworks and sculptures and big, huge paintings. They'll lift things from my QRZ page and they'll lift things from my website. Say, what a great concept, what a great idea, you know. I don't get any credit for it. Nothing ever comes to me. And then they say, David, do you like it? Do you like it? I say, well, why should I buy something that I created, you know? And it goes on like that, you know. And internet, it's so easy for people to lift ideas and to get things from there, you know. And the originality, there's none, there's none. And what do you do, you know? So I want to create something new. And I don't want to talk about it because if I do, everybody's going to run with the ball.
Okay, you don't need to talk about it, David. I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry if people are taking your ideas. I write these articles in the newsletter, basically Kings County and Limark, and my next one is going to be about propagation layers of, we always talk about D, E, and F, and where's A, B, and C, and one of the lines there is life ain't fair. And so, unfortunately, that's part of what you learn as you go through life, it ain't fair.
Darkness is the absence of light, KG2RY.
Let me veer back into the technical net. We had a little discourse on philosophy. I think, Bob, you wanted to ask some other questions, either technology or the virus questions?
KD2MVP. Yes, Roy. Yeah, actually, I sent you an email. Maybe you didn't see it, but anyway, maybe you know about this, maybe you don't. Just your comment on this. I saw an article in Physics Today, that little online magazine, about cellular nanosponges could neutralize SARS-CoV-2, you know, the virus. And, you know, the idea is these little sponges are, oh, I forget the details now, but they somehow block the viruses from linking up with the, or they suck them up or something. Do you know about this? Back to you.
Yeah, Bob, I remember you sending me the email. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to look into it. The beauty is that there are thousands and thousands of people doing a lot of research on the subject. We even have guys who listen to the Limark Technical Net who are organic chemists who are working in one of the medical schools on some aspect of COVID-19. So, you know, this is, they're going to unearth a whole bunch of interesting ideas, and maybe if we're lucky, 1 or 2% of them will pan out, and the others will go the way of all things, as they often do. So, you know, it's interesting whether it's legit, whether it will, you know, it can be, it's efficacious, it's safe, and it's cost effective. Is still a question.
Yeah, check out the article you chat. It's very short. You probably know about Physics World. They're all one-page articles. I guess I don't subscribe, so I can only read one or two, but they send, somehow I got on this mailing list, I'm not sure how. I get these things every day from Physics World, and this one looked interesting. The other question, have you heard about, I just listened to Michio Kaku's exploration show, you probably know about that, and he was mentioning that there is a swine flu that may be brewing that could be serious. He was calling it possibly a pandemic within a pandemic. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I think I sort of mentioned it at one point a week or so ago on Limark's Technical Net. They're watching China. There are H1N1 swine flu-like viral episodes going on. But it's impossible at this point to definitely say which is going to be the dominant influenza that's going to kind of catch fire across the world. You know, the next month or so is where they kind of make their best guesses, and they start off the process of creating vaccines specifically for that type. Could it get away from us? Could we end up with a swine flu slash coronavirus winter? Unfortunately, there is that possibility. Does anyone know what the odds are right now? No, no one knows what the odds are. It's another thing to be concerned about, but at this point, I wouldn't lose too much sleep right now.
Got you. I'm not really losing a lot of sleep, but he said the same thing. He just said a possibility. He didn't try to say how much of a possibility and blah, blah, blah. And he also mentioned that I guess there's a possibility of the coronavirus being sort of like flu, where vaccines might only be temporary, they might keep changing, and we might have to just keep getting booster shots and stuff. I mean, again, just saying this is one of many possibilities. So I guess you'd probably concur with that. We don't, but there's a lot we don't know. Back to you, Roy.
C2GS. Yeah, the problem is that even though this has been going on since at least late December, there's still a lot that we don't know. There's a lot of genetic drift. It seems not to change things too much. Then there's some people who think that maybe it's making it more infectious, but not necessarily less or more fatal. And other people thinking that it might be less fatal because the death rate seems to be low, but I think that's just a statistical aberration because of where we are on the time curve. Give it a couple more weeks and we'll know for sure whether the mortality rate of the strain is kind of changing slightly for different reasons. So there's about 10 trillion questions and about 3 answers at this point.
Got you, Roy. He also mentioned possible treatment, some optimism in this, like, what about some steroid that was also fairly inexpensive that shows good possibilities, or maybe they're already doing it, I'm not clear. This is for advanced cases when when your antibodies start attacking yourself, you know, it's trying to fight the disease, the antibody, your own antibodies end up killing you, I forgot the word for it. It would be useful in this case, a steroid that would slow down or reduce inflammation. But you got to know when to give it, because if you gave it too early, it might get in the way of your immune system when it's doing good. So you probably heard about this as well.
Yeah, it's methylprednisolone. It's very common. It's used a lot in hospitals. It's an anti-inflammatory steroid. And if you give it too early, you can knock out their immune system fighting out off the virus. The trick is to give it just at the right time, where you lessen the risk of the problem is your immune system finally overreacts to the viral load, and you go down this cascade of inflammatory processes that causes a lot more problems than it solves. So they've learned to use the steroids. They've learned to kind of modify their use of a respirator. In the old days when this first began, everyone who had any criteria for respiratory distress got put on a respirator, and the mortality rates were very high. So they're trying to delay it. When they finally do put them on respirators, they're using slightly different techniques. So, you know, we learn by our mistakes, we learn by practice. So probably the mortality rate in general, as long as we don't overwhelm the health system, will be less than it was in New York. If we overwhelm the health system in Arizona and California and Texas, we got a lot of problems.
I guess it's another reason why some people say get the disease early. I mean, this is crazy. And so they'll have immunity, which they may or may not have. But I say get the disease as late as possible, just to get it at all, because then there'll be more known about how to treat it.
I would agree. Forestall the inevitable as much as you can. You might get lucky and there might be herd immunity, or at the very least, your doctors will know a heck of a lot more, and hopefully you won't have it at the same time as thousands of others in your area that's clogging up the ambulance services and such. So, yeah, later is always better than earlier, unfortunately, with this. And, we'll figure it out eventually, but it's going to take us all time.
Very good, Roy. Thanks. I guess that's it for now. He said some other stuff. I couldn't remember it all. Doing stuff while he was on the show, cooking dinner, etc. But, good. Good to be positive as much as we can. Back to you, Roy. Thanks.
Very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club's technical net. It's on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. Let's go down to the TechNet puzzle for tonight, and I hope people want to play with it. Very simple. You don't need a illustration. It's all text. The question for tonight's puzzle is to decrease the sensitivity of a receiver. We talked about receiver sensitivity. Which of its controls should be switched in? So your choice is A, the notch filter, B, the AGC, C, the attenuator, and D, the clarifier. So does anyone want to play tonight?
I know the answer, but if someone else wants to give it a go, go ahead.
Bob, give it a go.
Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not sure what a clarifier is, but I think it's the attenuator, C.
You are quite right. A clarifier is also known as a receiver incremental tuning, or an RIT. Most of our radios now have RIT written in. When you're operating single sideband and there's another guy you're talking with and he absolutely positively refuses to admit that he's off frequency and you don't want to go off frequency with him, but you don't want him to sound like Donald Duck, you use the clarifier to adjust the receiving frequency so that his voice sounds normal. So that's a clarifier. Certainly doesn't do anything to sensitivity. Notch filters will drop down a short segment of the frequency. It doesn't really change the general sensitivity of the receiver. It just locally diminishes the signal. And AGC is an automatic gain control. They fluctuate, they raise and lower the gain. So not always do you decrease the sensitivity when you switch in the AGC. More than often, you raise it up. So it's not notch filters, it's not AGC, and it's not clarifier. So Bob is right. It's C, the attenuator. Attenuators just introduce loss to the signal, lower the amplitude of the input signal, and decrease the sensitivity of your receiver. Well, we've gotten to 10:30. Anyone with any other comments before we call it a show?
So just to clarify, does that mean that I have an RIT? There's a lot I still don't know about my own radio. So it's the same thing. So I can change the receive frequency, but change the transmit frequency with where it is. I wanted to comment, when you said the narrowing further back, when I was talking about you could narrow the signal, 700 could just have three filters, but you can go into those filters, that messes it a little. You can widen and narrow each of those filters by, you know, you can go into it, and then you turn, plus the tuning knob, but now it's doing that. It's widening in there with the filter. You can change the shape, what pitch, rounded or sharp. So you can do that on a 7100.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I've never really used it a lot as an HF radio. It's kind of my go-to UHF VHF radio, or if my flex goes bad, it's my emergency switchover. So I haven't really gone into things, but you know, usually if it's a touchpad that lets you swap between three filters, I'd be willing to bet you that about three quarters, if not nine tenths, of 7100 owners haven't really tweaked those settings much. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS, and if anyone has any closing comments for the technical net tonight, please let me know. Hey, Bob, I don't know what to tell you. My ICOM got very, very noisy. The signal that it got was very bad, so I switched over to my FT400, which was decent, and now it's not giving me a heck of a lot of signal. So you're about 95% noise for some strange reason.
Now I just increased my power.
It's much, much better.
Before the last transmission, was it as good as this? Curious.
Last two transmissions I can actually understand. Previous to that, you were kind of 95% in the noise.
In the entire net, like previously, a long time ago, I was asking other questions and all that.
You were understandable. It slowly degraded. I don't know exactly what's going on and why it's temporarily degrading. But when you first came on, I could hear you on the ICOM 7100. Then I had to swap over to the FT400, and then I couldn't hear you at all. So it was a gradual decline.
It wasn't optimal. I mean, I'll just keep it turned up, because I was going on 15% power, which is, 30% power. I was doing 15 watts. And now I'm doing like 25 watts, and I can just always do more power if it sounds better.
Like I said before, unfortunately, it seems to be time related. So when you started off earlier, back at about 9:05, the low signal was perfect, even for the ICOM 7100. I'm looking at the waveforms, and the FTM 400 is showing very nice audio waveforms, but the 7100 is still showing that it's noisy even with the boosted signal. So I'm not exactly sure what's been changing over time, like we talked earlier with Howard, the lowest possible power for the situation usually is a good idea. Use the power that you feel that you need. And in future, if you start getting noisy to me, I'll just tell you, and you can raise up the power.
It's the same antenna that I have. It's this diamond back out on a metal cabinet by my window. Usually works pretty well. Sometimes I get very good signals, I've been told, at this repeater on 5 watts through that antenna. So I'm just at the lowest tonight. Yeah, interesting.
The nature of radio. It requires a great deal of time in explaining why it's doing the things it's doing.
So my question that you couldn't hear through the noise, it was just confirming, I think, what you already said. When I use the RIT or the clarifier, what that does is it tweaks the receive frequency on a fine scale that leaves the transmit frequency at the same place, correct?
Very often you'll have two controls. You'll have an RIT that will independently change the receive frequency, and then there'll sometimes be an XIT in which you can independently shift the transmit frequency.
I see an RIT button on my... I'll read about it. Yeah, there's an RIT button. Sometimes I hit it by mistake. I didn't know what it was. So I don't see an XIT, so maybe I just have an RIT. I'll look in the manual. Thanks, Roy. This is Bob, KD2NVB.
Bob, as always, thank you for your participation, for your questions, for your playing the puzzle. Again, anyone else want to say anything before we shut her down for the night? Well, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be August 5th, which will be held by teleconferencing. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Our regular general meeting begins at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater, KC2RC. If you can communicate using Fusion Digital Technology, please join in. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode, either directly using Fusion Digital Technology radios or by using a hotspot and some other digital technology mode using our network's gateway, such as our XLX server. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater. That's located at stream.kc2rc.com. You just type in stream.kc2rc.com, and it will give you the audio feed. Members, as well as non-members, are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. And as always, the virus lives among us. It's not a good reason to panic and hide under a rock. Be safe. Be intelligent about this. There are measures to limit your risks. I urge you to take them. Even if your next-door neighbor doesn't, or your friend from across town, or some guy on television. Take care of yourself. Take care of your loved ones. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. So, it's time to roll this up and shut it all down. We'll be back to do it all over again July 22nd, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a safe, good week, and we'll meet again soon.
Three, Roy, this is WF2N.
From N2GOT.
Roy, KD2NBB.